It's crazy season here in Washington, D.C. The roundtable will discuss the latest scandals rocking the Beltway. New fiscal plans can solve the current debt crisis by one penny at a time. Just ask Congressman Mack. And, oh, by the way, that motorcade coming down the street, that would be Chancellor Angela Merkel coming down the street here in Washington. It's hot. It's crazy season. This is Backroom Politics. And it's Tuesday here in Washington, D.C. Actually, it's Tuesday everywhere. It's 4 o'clock here in the East Coast, and we're still here. It is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, live on Blog Talk Radio. Joining me, as they do every Tuesday, to my left, he is a former 8-term member of Congress from Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad. He is Congressman Al Swift. Al, welcome back.
I'm delighted. I'm still quaking from our visit by the motorcycle riders of Black.
Yeah, by the way, just to let you know, I've gotten control back of the show. In case you were wondering, I still have control of the show. Sitting directly across from me, as he does every Tuesday, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, welcome back.
Glad to be here. I wouldn't want to be anyplace else.
Exactly. Joining me to my right, as he does normally on Tuesdays when he's not in Hawaii or in Europe or traveling somewhere in the Far East, he is the Vice President of Business Development for the Eurasia Center. He is a bar-certified attorney in the District of Columbia and the great state of New York. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, welcome back.
Thanks, Justin. Glad to be here. Looking forward to an exciting show today.
And if Al can stop burning himself with a cigar, I think we can get started.
I dropped it into my crotch, and that's going to be real exciting.
Well, and the great thing about it is that's going to lead us into our first topic today.
I'm sure Anthony
Weiner
is getting excited to hear that.
Thank you for the segue, Al.
You really know how to start the program.
You do. These are crazy times right now in Washington, D.C. I will tell you right now, there are a lot of things going on. But we're going to start right now with the buzz that's on everybody's mind. The buzz is, obviously, leaders in government finding new and unique ways to create scandals. We're not going to talk about the specifics. The specifics are, in my opinion, they're personal to Congressman Anthony Weiner of New York. However, the larger scope of this creates a whole new question, but we'll get into that. The issue we're talking about is Congressman Weiner has gotten into a little bit of hot water in the media and within his own party, quite frankly, by originally saying that his Twitter account was hacked and inappropriate pictures were posted on Twitter accounts to random women across the country. Well, after a week of backtracking on the hacking story and not much coming out of the Weiner camp, yesterday a press conference was held where he stated for the full record that this has been going on for the past 3 years, and apparently there are more pictures out there. Now, I bring this up for a reason. We've seen a lot of scandals rock of this type, especially with social media. You know, the social media thing is just taking control over a lot of people's careers. A lot of people's futures has been hampered by this. You know, whether it's YouTube and Senator Mark Warner from Virginia using Macaca, YouTube took out Senator Warner's
That was Senator Allen.
Senator Allen, I'm sorry, Senator Allen, I apologize.
Senator Warner is still in.
Senator Warner, the former governor of Virginia, I apologize. That was Senator Allen, I apologize. That is correct. Senator Allen the Republican senator and senior senator at that time from the Commonwealth of Virginia, was caught on tape referring to his opponent's staffer as macaca, which is now, we come to find out, an unflattering term in many cultures in the world. So YouTube took that out. We've seen Facebook take out several people inside government. We've seen now, the latest is Anthony Weiner on Twitter. So this brings up a whole litany of questions. The first one I have to bring up is when a member of Congress gets into this type of situation, Washington's known for its spin. The question is, and not specific to Congressman Weiner, I want to reiterate, the issues that the congressman are dealing with, in my opinion, are personal. Those are his own personal displays. Those are his own personal interactions. What he does in the privacy of his own self is up to him. But from a larger scope, when we see these scandals come out, is it best to spin it the way he did, or is the truth just going to set you free? Al?
It's a huge problem because the media is going to spin it badly for you no matter what you do. If you initially say, yes, that was me, I did it, then they're going to say, well, have you done it before? And with whom? And who'd you send it to? And on and on and on. So maybe, while it looks stupid in retrospect, maybe denying it and taking your chances of trying to sell that story is not a bad second bet. But my advice to people would be, get the truth out as early as possible. You'll still get beat up by the media, but it will last for a shorter time.
You know, you have been around Congress for a long time. You've seen scandals rock Congress over the course of your span here inside the Beltway, Bob. Was this handled poorly, I mean, from the get-go, or is this something that they tried to spin it and the media just took it and took control of the whole situation?
Well, I think Al is right in this sense. No matter how you do it, whether you obfuscate for a while and then come clean, or whether you come clean at the beginning, the fact of the matter is, it's going to have a certain amount of life in the media. It's going, because it's a big story. A member of Congress or executive branch or something has done something that is salacious. It's the kind of thing that people want to, you know, Twitter about and talk about. And the reality is, there's no good solution to it. The best thing he could do, quite frankly, is quit. That's what I would do, I would think, if I got myself like it. Take, for example, what's the gentleman's name from the 26th District of New York? Cliff Lee, was that his name?
Chris Lee.
Right. When the freshman Republican, or, you know, these all, and so many of these of the new members are not former public officials. They're business people and whatnot. So they didn't have, you know, the idea of the what can go on in some ways. And one of the things the leadership did was just tell everybody, look, if you guys or gals get yourself in trouble, then, you know, we're not going to want you around here. We're going to suggest you leave, which is exactly what they did with Lee, and he left. And quite frankly, it's a lot cleaner that way, just to go away.
If he had been honest from the very beginning, people would have talked about it for sure for at least the next several weeks, but he would have been able to stay in Congress. An old friend and mentor told me, never lie to a reporter, because they will come back to bite you. These people are savvy, they're smart. Doesn't matter if you have a very good relationship with them. If you break that credibility and trust and lie to them, they're going to come back and destroy your career. The other thing he did was try and implicate Andrew Breitbart, insinuating it was he and his firm that tried to hack into his account. And that generates a lot of anger and resentment.
Right, and it turns out the congressman had to apologize to Breitbart over that accusation. But, you know, you brought up, Bob, an interesting point is, you know, the question going around the Beltway round now is, can he survive this? There's a poll that was released today that nearly half of New York City voters want Weiner out. He's apparently in New York City lost the trust of his constituents, and he's coming from a district that's got a lot of stroke. you're talking about a very affluent section of Queens, affluent section of Brooklyn, strong support in parts of the Bronx. When you look at that, and New York City saying, look, we just don't want you there anymore, is this a sign, Al, that he's just got to bow out and maybe go to K Street and let this all break down?
I would remind you that there was a congressman accused of having an affair with a young man, a homosexual affair with a young man, who was no longer a page. He was censured. He stood in the well and got the Riot Red Act to him and responded.
Was that Gary Stubbs?
Yes. And he was reelected several times before he retired. Barney Frank survived a scandal like this. So I would not bet money that Wiener can't win again in New York. If this were in Arizona, I would think the odds would be different.
Well, the question really will become whether the Democratic Party in New York City wants him to run or not, because obviously if the party says to him, you should quit and we're going to run a candidate against you in your primary next time, that is, to me, that is the way it ought to be handled. This is a party matter. Right now, it's a matter for the party. And if nothing happens at this point, the next time it comes up, it's a matter of the
voters. And the party carries weight in New York. Yeah. The party doesn't carry any weight in some states, whether it should or not, in Washington state.
But the fact that he lied and tried to cover up this whole incident is going to hurt.
Yeah. If you admit up front, you look better than when you lie up front and then have to go.
One of the things we have to look at is, I mean, right now the New York City delegation hasn't been really batting 1,000 when it comes to ethics issues. We still have to deal with it. You know, they're still wrangling, no pun intended, with the Charlie Rangel issue. He came out and backtracked, denied. He got censured and is still serving, representing the part of Manhattan that he does. We saw that. Can Wiener follow that same track? Is this going to amount to maybe censure?
It seems to me that you ought to be able to make a distinction between doing something that is illegal and something that is simply not smart. And he didn't show anything that you can't see in the men's section of any Sunday newspaper ads for Hex.
But if he used government property to send the tweets or to make the phone calls, that brings up another issue,
issue, and that's where I think
it's not really technical.
First the media, and then, forgive me, the damn lawyers start making mountains out of molehills.
Taxpayer money that's going to pay for his office and for his tweets.
Outside of the legalities, the legality right now is going to be in the hands of the Ethics Committee. Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi has called for the Ethics Committee to take this issue up. This is going to go in front of a hearing. Probably there will be at least censure on this.
And it will take a long time before it happens.
And I think by that time, this will probably fall out. But it goes to the bigger question. Al and Bob, you guys have been around the Beltway longer than any of us. And we've talked about this before. I brought up Joe Scarborough's article and his thoughts of, you know, when you first get elected, the best thing you can do is bring your whole family up here. Because if you come up here solo, the whole mantra of this town is just going to eat you alive and you're going to get caught up in stuff like that.
I totally agree with that.
But is that aura so powerful in this town that it just sucks you in? Al, you were a member of Congress. You would know.
Well, I was a member of Congress a long enough time ago. I can remember when there was a chairman of a major committee who was a known drunk. It never, ever made the papers. There was a lot of hanky-panky, sexual hanky-panky going on. Never made the papers.
But it was generally known among the insiders.
It was generally known among the insiders, both the press and Congress. Now, I think that was too far in the other direction. But I've always said this is a town in which the pendulum never stops in the middle.
But you never had the 24-hour media like you do now.
Well, there are a lot of reasons for the change, but we have gone from where I think there were things that were covered up or not reported that probably should have been reported.
Well, there was always,
and they go all the way over to where now we're worried about underpants and pictures.
Well, you know, the funny thing about it is, you know, seeing how the media has truly driven a lot of this, and if you look back, I mean, there was talk back in the 60s of the infidelities of President John F. Kennedy. That never really went widely reported. I mean, we can go back to FDR. There was always a little bit of buzz about his fidelity to Eleanor. You know, all of that.
I never
out.
Heard that. Of course, I was 5 years old.
Oh, I thought you were chief of staff to Senator Ruckel. The you know, when we go back and we look at, you know, down the line, the how the media has evolved to where it is now, which is worse, the actual act or the media drawing it out and to get ratings and to get stature?
I think it varies from issue.
Right.
I think when it's illegal in a major way, such as graft, which the act itself is illegal, then I think absolutely the media should be on it. When it gets down to pictures of underpants, I really am.
It's horribly embarrassing for his wife. My heart just goes out to her.
Yeah.
What she must be going through.
Well, and yeah.
I agree. And by the way, for those of you who are out there listening, you can join us in the discussion. The number here is 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. If you'd like to be on the air with the roundtable here at Shelley's Back Room in Washington, D.C. Just to finish out this segment, I want to go back to the original question. Does Anthony Weiner survive this?
My guess is yes.
Bob?
My guess is yes, because I don't think the party will want to throw him out.
Ralph, yes for now, but they will redistrict him out.
Wow. Interesting take. We're going to take about a 2-minute break. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, live on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. Thank you. And welcome back to Shelley's Back Room here in downtown Washington, D.C., America's premier cigar tavern. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. And by the way, you can now listen to us on your smartphones on the mobile Blog Talk Radio app. We're going to talk a little bit, for those of you who are joining us, we were talking about the latest crisis to deal with, that we have to deal with here in Washington, that being the issue surrounding Congressman Anthony Weiner out of New York City. But we're going to change focus right now.
We're going to something important.
Something important, yes. and it's hugely important right now. The huge issue of the continuing fiscal crisis in this country continues to snowball. It is something that is now, in some instances, costing political credibility and political credit. It is, in some instances, causing a lot of discourse internal to the parties, and we'll touch on that here in a second. And it's something that's continuing to drive financial markets and the international economic community into turmoil. So when we look at all this, let's take a look at the latest that's happening. The stat that just came out, and Bob, thank you very much for that stat, is for the first time in recent memory, the stock market, the financial markets, not just here, but globally, have had five consecutive weeks of downturns. We started off 5 weeks ago around 12 and change. We're now below 11,000.
No. We're below 12,000.
We're now below 12,000. I'm sorry, we're below 12,000. We started off at 12 and change. We're now below 12,000. That is a serious
hit. We've lost about 500 points in the stock market.
That's very interesting take. But when we talk about this, the one thing we're noticing is, number one, we're starting to see a lot more of the foreign governments taking stronger positions on the current global economic crisis. Ralph, you saw that at the GA conference 2 weeks ago, and you happened to be there. What exactly was happening in the foreign governments taking a lot more control of their own independent fiscal crises, and how does it relate to the global side?
Well, one of the main issues was the G8 has pledged $40 billion over 3 years to help Egypt and Tunisia come out of their Arab Spring. About 20 of it is going to be allocated by financial institutions like the IMF, the World Bank. Another 10 is going to come from the GA member countries themselves, and the balance will come from Gulf states. You're also seeing a major commitment to help EG8. Was a really big area where they're trying to regulate.
What is that?
Yeah, that EG8 was put together by CEOs of the different internet companies like Google, Microsoft, Facebook. They came together and put forth some policy recommendations on how do you manage the internet.
Thank you.
Okay, so when we look at the G8 and how they're getting involved, I mean, the fact that we're now having to get involved and the GA countries are having to put direct skin in the game, for lack of a better term, that's the second time you've done that, Al.
Yeah.
For those of you all out in radio land, Al has dropped his cigar into a nondescript place for the second time in so many minutes.
Ow.
Exactly.
Hey, can I ask Ralph a question?
Sure.
Because I'm interested in what your take is on the fact that as the Euro universe, Western Europe, has been looking at Greece again and Portugal and Ireland and Spain, and it's you know, they're really being very reluctant to put more skin in the game, so to speak.
Well,
I think that is partly due to, number one, the fact that, you know, they're all having trouble. Everybody's got a problem now, so to speak.
Dominique Strauss-Kahn had a very good bailout plan for Greece. However, it came under fire because of the fact that it was going to hurt the other G8 member countries. Christine Lagarde was very much against bailing out Greece because it was going to mean higher costs to the other members. Now, since that time, I believe Germany has come in and said they are going to help bail out Greece. But there's also a renewed commitment to helping the African countries and fighting AIDS and inoculating children against tuberculosis and malaria. And so they talk about all these great initiatives, but it's going to come down to, do they have the funds? And China is now a real big question mark because they're not a member of the G8, they're a member of the G20, but they are the ones that have the money. They're the ones that can fund a lot of these initiatives.
But the question then comes up, and this is going to be a problem, it's going to be a sales problem inside each individual country, is, you know, we've got our own problems here. Why are we having to bail out the Arab Spring? Why are we having to bail out Africa? These should be. We're now coming full circle to a situation where we're going to see a lot more hints of isolationism. My problems are my problems internally. You deal with your problems. Is that an underlying tone that you saw at the G8?
Well, what I saw at the G8 was there was a strong moral imperative, especially coming out of Sarkozy and his administration. They believe it's very important to help the people in the Middle East and North Africa realize their goals and aspirations. But in order to do that, they have to have sound financial footing, and there also has to be the political, right political vacuum associated with the movement. So you don't have fundamentalists and extremists filling the void. That's what they're very concerned about. They have to have both the political institutions in place where the rule of law is going to be respected, and at the same time have the financial situation in place so that people's goals, dreams can be realized. People can have jobs and economic security.
But Al, how do we sell that concept of, you know, we're part of a global community, we're part of a global economy? How do we sell that internally in a country particularly like ours? We've got to appropriate that money to the international community.
I think that the first thing that we didn't do that we should have done, which was to explain very carefully in a bipartisan way to our own people what our situation is. We started, the Republican plan, I think, was laudatory in the sense that they at least put their foot in the water, which is more than the Democrats have done, but they did it before we had explained the absolute importance of this. And so if you start taking things away from people and they're not convinced it's necessary, they are going to raise hell. So just doing what we need to do in our own country is going to be very, very controversial. Then if we're giving money away, which was your question, to other countries, that's going to be doubly controversial.
But Bob, which comes first? I mean, we're literally getting to a chicken and egg situation of, if we don't put the money into Africa, we're going to see countries like Yemen, some of the outer horn of Africa, start to become more unstabilized. But yet, that money we can use here to help solve our own fiscal problems.
Well, that's true, but look at it, we have to also look at it. My guess is that we're really stuck on a dilemma on the horns. We're going to have to do both at more or less the same time. As an example, if you pay attention to what some of these different countries that have had Arab Spring events around, you discover that the Muslim Brotherhood is not just in Egypt, it's here, there, and everywhere. It's over in Syria, it's in Tunisia, it's down in Yemen, and they're getting involved with all these Arab Spring groups, and they're probably the best organized political activity group around. Now, what that means probably is that they're probably less friendly to the West than maybe only in every other organized group in any of those countries, which is a problem for us just in the fact that we don't want a bunch of angry countries who don't like the West.
Right, but Ralph, it also begs the question, though, the countries that we're talking about, in particular, we talk about Egypt, we talk about Bahrain, these are all countries that have affluence onto their own selves. There's oil money in Bahrain, there's oil money in Egypt, there's still a strong economic center in Africa, in Cairo. Why is it the responsibility of the G8 to move forward in bailing out those countries? It seems like they should be able to at least get control of their own house, get their own house in order, before we start coming in and cleaning house for them.
And there is a strong emphasis on trying to get the well-to-do people in those countries to sort of to foot the bill. But it's very hard because in those countries you have a sort of a class system where the money is concentrated in the hands of the oligarchs, and the majority of the people have no rights, they have no jobs, they are basically living as slaves and serfs. And this is what has generated this revolution, people wanting reform.
Right. Bob?
Yeah, I don't want what I said a moment ago to sound as though I want to just pour money into every place in the Middle East.
No.
But the fact of the matter is, we have a real interest in the place, you know, turning out to be a place that is stable, sensible, and the whatever middle class is out there grows, and the jobs are available, and people can live a good life. And probably there are more organized bodies in most of those countries who want to control it themselves rather than let a democracy flourish, if you will.
But Al, as a former member of Congress, you've been part of the appropriation process and the budgetary process for several of your terms. This has got to be a hard sell inside the halls of Congress as far as appropriating this funding, whether it goes through USAID, USTDA, or it's just direct funding into the IMF.
Of course, it's going to be difficult because it's going to be hard to explain to everybody's constituents, and not everybody up in Congress is a hero and wants to go out on a limb. So sure, but I go back to my original point when all this started. If we had explained this, I was talking with a congresswoman who said, and I said this to her, and she says, "Oh, don't worry." She says, "My constituents know about this." Well, they know that
we got a problem.
They know we got a problem. They do not understand the details of the problem or how difficult it's going to be or how painful it's going to be in order to right the situation. That's the part we haven't.
But Ralph, this brings up a question, though. If we, I mean, I'd like to think America as a educated, especially politically educated, constituency, if we're having problems explaining it and our constituents can't grasp hold of it, how's the expectation in some of the developing world going to be that they can understand and they can grasp onto that?
The big issue surrounding the G8 is, and the reputation they've had in the past is, it's a bunch of leaders that come together, slap each other on the back, have drinks and dinner, make all these promises and go home and nothing gets done. Now, David Cameron, in his press conference, reiterated the point that that's not why we're here. We're here because we want to get things accomplished. We're going to not only make promises, we're going to follow through.
And David Cameron ran on a platform like that. Probably more than any other industrialized democracy, laid some groundwork for his people to better understand it.
Absolutely.
We haven't. I don't know of any other.
The French have a problem because Sarkozy is not popular within France. He's popular abroad, but he's having a hard time gaining support within France. So it's going to be very interesting to see how the French react to the proposal to help the Arab Spring.
Right. But we've talked about David Cameron numerous times on the show. I mean, I think we're all in consensus by saying, look, he's one of the more gutsy heads of state that are out there. But David Cameron has done it, but he's done it to serious political outfall in his own constituency. There's now talk of the coalition government possibly collapsing. That's at least what we see here. Now, an interesting point is, talking with some folks from Great Britain, the folks in Great Britain are taking a little bit of a different view of it that we're hearing here in the States. They're actually very supportive of David Cameron. Words that we hear about the possible collapse of coalition government, they're backing, not so much the government, but they're backing David Cameron for taking this type of stand. Now, this ties into what we've said before is, why don't we find leadership in this country that will take that similar stand? It's a broken record on this show, but it still is as accurate a question today as it was 5 weeks ago.
If you talk to people abroad, I mean, when I was at the G8, everyone loves Obama. They think he's the greatest president the U.S. has ever had. They think his policies are wonderful. The French, they like him. They they believe that his Palestinian, Israeli-Palestinian proposal is workable. So he's very popular abroad, but how does he communicate and translate that to the voters here? That's the question.
But ironically, what we have is a situation where we have the same situation here in the United States. Obama's numbers are down into the low 40s,
right.
But overseas, they love him. Sarkozy, right. We love Sarkozy here, but he's got similar problems right. back inside.
It's very very interesting conundrum.
Maybe
and how
they
do you solve it?
Places.
Yeah.
You want to give us Sarkozy? Right. You just want the first lady. That's what you want. Let's be
and
real.
It all depends whether you believe they're both sincere. I think coming out of the G8, everyone felt both Obama and Sarkozy are very, very sincere in what they want to accomplish.
When you were at the G8, did you... Go ahead, Bob. I'm sorry.
But just look at the difference. We're just talking about how gutsy Cameron was.
Yeah.
Not only did he say he was going to do it, he campaigned on it, which is exactly what you have to do when you're running for election, but he lived up to it. Now, Obama is in a little bit of a different situation, but... I mean, just when we take a look at the problems of the deficit, and the fact is that the President of the United States, who is the agenda setter for policy discussions in the United States, has yet to put on the table a serious budget proposal. And I understand that the Vice President has got a group talking, and there's still the group of six talking in the Senate, and other people are talking. But the real problem is that the guy who's got the best chance to help the public, as Al said, understand the problem, ain't telling the public what the problem is. Most of the public believe that if we would just cut off foreign aid, we have hundreds of billions of dollars to spend other places. That's crazy.
Well, let's hold off on that, because when we come back, we kind of talked about the international front on this, and you know, having the perspective of Ralph being actually at the G8 is fantastic. But I think what we now need to do is let's take a look at it domestically and what we're dealing with here. Several new proposals are coming out of the woodwork slowly but surely, but the leadership questions call Harry Reid has got a problem, and we'll talk about that when we come back. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom in Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Thank you.
And we're back live here in Shelley's back room in Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. If you were joining us in our last segment, we were talking about the current fiscal crisis from the international perspective and some of the interesting items that came out of the G8. But I think it's tying very much into what's happening here domestically now, and the fiscal crisis continues to be a quagmire that eludes both parties' leadership on many levels. The latest story coming out of this is there's now some serious dissent in the Senate about the leadership of Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. There's a lot of grumbling inside the Democratic Party, and the basic paraphrase coming out of everybody is, where's the leadership? Where's our proposal? Who's coming up with this, and who's running with the football? It's a question that we've asked many times on this show, to no avail. Nobody seems to be hearing an answer out of anybody. But now I guess it's starting to come. There's some serious players in this. Senator from California, Dianne Feinstein, was quoted in Politico today as saying, on the budget front, I'm not a happy camper around here, unquote. She went on to say that, quote, I think we need to have a budget that we stand by, unquote. Yet there's no proposal coming out of her office either. And the Republicans aren't doing any better. Again, the only person is, and the only one we're seeing until recently, has been the Paul Ryan budget proposal, and nobody seems to be standing around that. Now then, on the flip side of that, there's the Connie Mack situation. But we'll get to that in a second. Let's go back to the leadership issue. Is Harry Reid seriously in trouble, and is he the one that needs to stand up now?
Harry Reid may be in trouble. I don't know. We'll have to see. But the Senate is almost unleavable in its current situation. If you really want to go to the basis of this, and you get right back to one of Bob's and my favorite topics, we don't have a center in this country much. We have a very weak center. The Republicans have almost no center. The Democrats have less center than they did before the last election. And the center is where you work these things out. So the Republicans in the House are almost unleadable because you've got the Tea Party, which appears to be loyal to no one in Republican leadership. Then you have the natural Republican right that also limits the leadership to what they can propose. And then you have the United States Senate, as I've always said, the least democratic institution on the face of the earth. And to expect our institutions to respond to this very difficult problem when there is a very weak center is very hard to do.
But Bob, one of the points that came out in one of the articles that we read on our friends at Politico's website. It just seems right now that for Harry Reid in particular, but for a lot of the leadership, there's a quote-unquote catch-22, is if Harry Reid or John Boehner take ambitious approaches to solving the fiscal crisis, it's going to cost them in 2012. Is the election, in fact, driving the hesitancy for somebody to stand up and take a leadership role in this?
Well, probably it is to some degree. I mean, after the loss of the election on the Republican side and in that New York district last week, it probably has got people's attention, number one. But I don't think that's the biggest thing. The biggest problem, I think, is that the people on Capitol Hill know what has to be done. And they also know that if they stand up and say, this is what we're going to do to fix the problem, they're going to have an awful lot of people back home really unhappy with them because they're going to say, you're going to take away my Medicare, you're going to take away my Social Security, you're doing this, you're doing that, you're cutting all these programs I like, blah, blah, blah.
When the Democrats step in, they're going to say, you're weakening the military.
Yeah, and so the problem is you're going to have to – the only solution is a solution that nobody has yet been willing to say we have to do in the privacy of a small room, and that is we all are going to have to give some skin. We're not going to have to lose any limbs, but we're all going to have to lose some skin we're going to have to join hands and just do the job.
Rip the Band-Aid off and let it go.
And when the people complain, we're going to have to say, this is the best we could do as a group of liberals and conservatives who are trying to find a middle ground when there's almost no middle in either party.
My greatest fear is you're going to have an almost total economic collapse in this country for people to wake up and agree to something
you
like that.
You've got
to
scare the heck out of them.
Yeah.
But at some point, a total economic collapse is just not an option. I mean,
it's going to have to come down to like that because so many people have entrenched beliefs that these programs they're entitled to these programs and they have a right to this sort of thing. And the problem is we cannot, as a country, continue to function without massive across-the-board cuts that everyone has to do.
And we have gotten ourselves in a situation where the entitlements that we have take up better than 40% of the federal budget. I mean, it's just astonishing.
And then you add the military budget to it.
That's another 24%.
You've got over 50% of the budget tied up in three things.
Yeah.
But now, as a result of a lot of the grumbling that we're hearing from the Capitol, there are some slight, modest, kind of quiet, under-the-table positioning ideas, thoughts coming out of some additional members. The one I pointed out earlier is Representative Connie Mack out of Florida was on Morning Joe this morning on MSNBC, and he was talking about his one-penny solution, that if we take one penny from every federal dollar we spend in the budget, we will be able to solve this fiscal crisis. In your opinion, Al, as a former member, does that have legs in your opinion?
That's a 1% across-the-board cut. And I don't know. I don't know all the numbers. 1% sounds so small. But
1% of $100 trillion is a lot of money.
That's right.
It's a trillion.
Yeah. You're looking at a substantial decrease, but is that just too small of a spoon to dig out this hole?
I don't know. I don't know the numbers.
No.
I need an economist but it seems to me that it's a good place to begin. It's an idea, and aside from Paul Ryan's, we don't have ideas on the table.
What's interesting is if we figured it out right, that it's about $1 trillion at that number. It's interesting that that Eric Cantor, Republican majority leader in the House and a member of the team working with Vice President,
the Gang of Five now.
Yeah. No.
Vice President's Commission, correct.
Eric Cantor has said that there is general agreement on about $1 trillion of cuts, which means that I don't think that they're doing it on a 1% of everything. But what they're talking about, coupled with what Congressman Mack is talking about, would probably get us closer to $2 trillion than one. And when you start to get to $2 trillion in cuts, that's about the number we're going to have to get to.
It now, has this advantage in terms of the public's response. It sounds fair. It sounds reasonable. Certainly, you can cut 1%, will be the general attitude. So it might be something easier to sell. You will find out down the line what the 1% does to you, and that may not be as heavy.
Well, the one thing noticeably vacant from that presentation was what he doesn't say is, A, it's across the board. That means you've got to hit non-discretionary spending, which, by the way, that includes Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. And for a congressman coming from the coast of Florida, that's a ballsy move. He's not going to say that because that will get him unelected, particularly with the senior voters down in his part of the state.
But you know the Democrats are going to go after him on that.
Of course they are. Of course they are. The Democrats are going to go after him saying, hey, you're touching discretionary spending. You're taking away entitlements. The Republicans are going to come around saying, hey, you're talking about messing with national defense and homeland security. You can't do that. And we're back in the same situation that we have.
Well, what we have to do is both sides have to start saying to the other side, aha, but you're cutting this. you know, they have. We have to stop talking about gotcha politics on cutting everything and sit down and talk about how we're going to figure out a cut for. And the idea of a 1% cut is a good idea from the standpoint, as Al said, everybody takes a little bit of a harm, but nobody gets hurt.
Al is cringing. Al is cringing.
What I'm cringing about is that we are absolutely overlooking a revenue increase because
exactly.
The Republicans
have
said that they won't go.
And
what if you did it 0.5% cuts and 0.5% in a tax increase, or maybe 1% in each? Whatever makes
sense. But
how
are you going to stimulate small business if you have all these cuts? This is the other issue. You're going to have to have these targeted cuts that get rid of waste, fraud, and abuse, but at the same time...
Wait. I've had waste, fraud, and abuse up to my ears. First of all, I would like somebody to explain to me how much money you save by cutting abuse. I mean, it's a standard phrase.
Right.
You're going to save a lot of money by eliminating
Nobody's
abuse.
Nobody's been able to put a number associated with waste, fraud, and abuse.
What the hell does abuse mean? I mean,
well,
abuse
you're gonna have
usually
to have
comes
look.
Cheap.
Yeah.
You know?
But,
so the waste, fraud, and abuse thing, I think, is a right wing dream.
Well, it doesn't get you any. It's like saying foreign aid, and you got a lot of money. You don't.
Well, but here's the thing is the one thing that we haven't talked about is, and it was noticeably vacant also from the presentation that we heard from Congressman Mack this morning, and in fact, when they asked him about it, it was Governor Ed Rendell that asked him about, hey. What about, you know, how are you going to do what you're going to do? That doesn't fix the revenue generation issue.
No.
We can make all the cuts we have, but if all we're doing is cutting from a baseline, we still have to generate. There are more people in this country than there were 10 years ago. As a result, we have to generate revenue that is equal to that support that we give to that population base. That is something that is gone unheard of inside the beltway here, Ralph.
And that's what I'm getting at. We have to promote small business. That is the engine of growth in this country. We cannot turn a blind eye to them when we decide we're just going to cut indiscriminately. The other issue is the international community is looking at us to see how we're moving forward. We could lose our AAA credit rating if we don't do something very, very soon. Any proposal on the table is going to be evaluated very seriously by the international
community. And that's fine, but the reality still dictates we have to take a serious look at, and look, I'm a Republican, I'm a very moderate Republican, but I will tell you, this goes against my party line of, if I ran a business, I have to generate revenue. I can cut all day long.
I still have to generate
money.
And what the Democrats and the liberals have to understand is that there's got to be, and let's use the term reform of Medicare and Medicaid, in ways that will save some money. Maybe it's not just cut, but you're going to have to do some strategic thinking and reform.
But in defense of the Republicans have come up with some solutions. Maybe we need to privatize. Maybe there's a certain level of privatization. David Cameron's talking about privatizing the National Health Service in England. Why can't we privatize some of Medicare and Medicaid to generate revenue? Those companies that supply the private health care can generate and pay taxes into the pot.
Because people remember what happened in 2008 with the economic collapse. And they're worried that if we privatize Medicare, Social Security, that they're just going to lose everything.
But how, you lost me on that one, Ralph.
If we talked about setting up private accounts for Social Security,
Whether we do private accounts or Social Security, but even if
you're relying on the stock market, basically.
But even if we took out Social Security, if we just looked at Medicare, Medicaid, a service that is being provided by the federal government, if we privatize that, but every time the Republicans bring up privatization, Democrats start looking at it, going, "Oh, wait a minute, this is just federal welfare for the big healthcare community." They're still paying taxes. Whether it's their fair share, they're still putting revenue back into the system. Why is that a bad idea for Democrats?
Well, why is new revenue a bad idea for Republicans? It's because we've got rigidly set things that each party wants to protect, and they we have too many sacred cows.
That's true.
We have Republican sacred cows and we have Democratic sacred cows, and as each stands staunchly behind their traditional positions on their sacred cows, we get nothing done.
We get deeper and deeper in the hole.
But here's the other problem, though. Your sacred cow from Washington's 2nd District is different from the sacred cow that is in Florida's 24th District. In Florida's 24th district, they've got a problem where they've got a fledgling economy in a state where foreclosures are at the top of the nation, and they've got a space program that has pretty much been the lifeblood of that region going away.
Yes.
So that sacred cow is different from your sacred cow in Washington State.
Well, they're all different. The point is they're all sacred.
So how do we get around touching the sacred cows? Do we just say everything's on the table?
I think that we have to get to a point where you've got a proposal on the table which does all these things, that does a little bit to all the sacred cows, and argue it out from there, rather than saying, well, we can't put on the table the military budget, we can't put on the table revenue increases, we can't put on the table Medicare and Medicaid.
But all we have now is an empty table. Now, what we're looking at internationally is the sacred cows, obviously, in foreign countries are going to be different, but they're still dealing with Ireland in particular, has an economy that's very much similar like the American economy, yet they're tanking and they've gone to the point where they're just voiding out any of the loan payments they've got to do. They're saying, look, we'll start from scratch. They're essentially claiming bankruptcy on them.
And they're hoping the EU is going to come in and bail them out.
Yeah.
But who, now, if we
nobody's
can't take that,
bail,
nobody's going to bail us out.
No, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Right.
So, Bob, I go to you now on the other side of the aisle, and we ask the question, you know, we have an empty table. If we put everything on the table, who is going to put that leadership forward? Or whose responsibility is it?
Well,
the reason you've got an empty table is there isn't any leadership.
Yeah, there's one leader. Yeah. Right now in this situation, we go back to our old sacred friend, Paul Ryan.
Right.
Chairman Ryan's the only one standing up for this.
Yeah.
So God bless Chairman Ryan, but he still had his budget voted down in the Senate.
I think that I have been saying for the last...
Once and a half.
3 months. We need, the president sets the agenda. It doesn't make a difference what party he is or what his philosophy is. The president is the agenda setter in our system of government. And we just have to hope that the president will exercise leadership. Now,
and the best chance of that may well be through
the Biden group.
The Biden group.
Yeah.
Because that is part of the administration.
Yeah. The gang of six in the Senate is having
problems.
Gang of five now. That's why it's having problems. And right now, it may be that the Biden group, which is pretty much evenly divided, it's got leadership people from both parties in both houses, along with the vice president, and they're working, trying to get a unanimous agreement on how they're going to find ways to both raise revenue and cut costs. Now, if they can come up with a system, a program, some kind of an idea, more than just an outline, but some specifics that lead into what we have to cut, if they can do that and lead into what we have to, how we raise, and how we raise it is more important than how much we raise, we can find a solution. But we're going to have leadership, and it comes down to the administration. It's their job. It's basically, this problem sits on the president's desk, staring him in the face, and has for months.
But there's still an inherent responsibility of the Republican leadership in the House, and we go to our friend...
You're right.
Speaker Boehner.
Absolutely.
Now, I'll tell you right now, one of the best ideas I've heard coming out of the White House in recent memory on this crisis is President Obama is taking Speaker Boehner to go play golf. You want to know something? Look, we've solved so many problems sitting around this table drinking Jack Daniels and martinis, smoking cigars. Maybe we need to have some golf course.
Well,
I can tell you
that's a very positive first step.
I can tell you that 30 years ago and plus, you know, Jerry Ford and Tip O'Neill playing golf together solved more problems than most of us know.
Yeah, but your story also ends with Tip O'Neill getting in a car saying, I got to go find a way to screw you.
Yeah, but that was okay because the Republicans still got something. See, and that's the point. When Al and I were talking earlier about there is no center anymore. The problem is we have to create an artificial center that exists because we're in such dire straits that even people who aren't in the center are willing to join hands with somebody on the other side who they would not normally join hands with and say, yeah, it's so bad, we got to fix it, and I'll give this, but you got to give something too. But I mean, you can't say something is off the table because I say it is.
But most politicians are not at that stage yet.
You're exactly right.
But the problem we run into is the general electorate sees the Speaker of the House, a Republican, and the President of the United States, the de facto leader of the Democratic Party, on a golf course striking deals. It strikes a backroom politics. Is that valid? Is that fair? Al?
Look, the term backroom politics certainly suggests that something nefarious is going on.
Maybe we should change the name of this show.
Fact is that you can't sit down with 535 people up there and say, well, now let's all get together and we'll work this out. Somebody, some small group, and maybe it's Biden's, maybe it's not, maybe it's the group of five, but somebody's got to sit down and say, if I give here, will you give there? That's got to go on.
And that has to be in a small group, in a small room, because when you do it in public, everybody goes bananas.
Yeah, just the suggestion that you are going to give somewhere will bring the wrath of God from your side down on you. So you need to circle the wagons, get a small group to come and present something, and then the debate can start. But it's currently, all we've got is one plan, and it's one
and nobody's standing behind that one plan.
The Republicans aren't standing behind it, and the Democrats are attacking it.
The Democrats feel that they can win by just attacking. I mean, that was the whole issue in the New York race.
I think you're correct. But what I think, and going back to that infamous ad in that election of Paul Ryan lookalike pushing Grandma off the cliff, the fact is we need an ad that says no matter what we do, if we sit here on our hands, Grandma's going off the cliff.
Right,
that's exactly
whether Paul
right.
Paul Ryan is pushing the wheelchair or not.
Yeah, absolutely. Which now begs the question, and it goes back to a point of, you know, do we allow the man-to-man talk, come up with a plan on the golf course saying, okay, when we get to the 19th hole, let's put it in writing, let's send it up to the hill, let's make this happen. Or is there going to have to be some sort of public messaging that says, hey, look, you know, the backroom deal we did, we're going to have this transparent. Is transparency a reality in this situation, Bob? Or Al, go ahead.
Well, it becomes transparent once you lay it out.
And both sides start talking about it to their people and say, we had to give this, but we saved the country.
And we got this.
Yeah.
But the one problem we have heard is the influence of the external forces, that being the K Street forces. Is this something that Congress is willing to tell everybody on K Street? And for those of you who are not inside the Beltway, when we talk K Street, read lobbyists. Are they going to tell the special interest groups, everybody just take a stand on the sidelines, we'll get to you, but let us come up with something first? Is Congress willing to make that call? Al?
So far, it hasn't. But
Bob?
Exactly.
I would suggest that the biggest problem is what each side fears about their supporters if they give too much. So I'm talking about the public. Now, I think that the lobbyists and the interest groups are going to basically, everybody will probably be a little bit unhappy, but the interest groups are going to be much more realistic, I think, than the general public. I think they're more easily convinced that we have to do something on both sides giving than the public is.
Plus, if you put everything on the table, everybody's going to be yelling about it.
Yeah.
You know, and the conservatives are going to see that, the Democratic leadership has got problems. The Democrats will see that the Republicans have got problems, and they can't say, you're just taking it all on my hide, and the public is going to learn something.
Ralph, you're going to need a real statesman coming out of the House and the Senate that's really going to be willing to put their career on the line
with the
plan.
You need a lot of them.
Well, we've only seen one.
We had John Quincy Adams at one time.
I mean, look at the Democrats that were willing to go down in defeat by pushing their version of health care. I mean, whatever you want to say about them, at least they were noble, they were honorable, because you saw where they stood on that particular issue.
Well, and we're going to have a lot of people are going to have to say, I'm willing to take a chance because the government is in such deep, deep, dire straits.
Right. All right, well, we're going to take a break at this point. When we come back, we're going to continue the fiscal discussion on this topic and maybe even come up with a plan of our own. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. At Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics, live on Blog Talk Radio. Joining me, as always, Congressman Al Swift, the Honorable Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie. I'm your moderator, J.T. Russell, and we're going to continue the discussion of the fiscal issue. Bob, after we went to break, you brought up a really interesting point, which I think is something that not a lot of people think that there could be a tie-in. You think that the situation, the solution to, or a possible help to the fiscal problem is, in fact, redistricting this problem out. Talk a little bit about that.
Justin, it works something like this. If you today are running for a seat in the House of Representatives, in about 80%, maybe a little more, maybe even 90% of the districts, your biggest problem is likely to be not your opponent in the general election, it's likely to be your opponent in the primary, which means that you are, if you are a Democrat, you've got to watch your left, your extreme left. If you're a Republican, you've got to watch the Tea Party's extreme right. Now, that means that we're driving the middle out of the House of Representatives. We've been talking about the need for the parties and to join hands together to solve this budget problem, but it's hard to find anybody in the middle. Everybody's way over here, and they're on each end, and they're afraid to step forward and get into the middle because they'll get shot at too quick.
Where does redistricting come into this?
Well, because the way redistricting is done now,
in too many states,
in most states of the union, what happens is the congressional delegation, after the census, and they know how many districts they're going to be allotted to their state, they sort of cut deals with the state legislature to protect everybody they can and guarantee that most districts have probably, I would think, and Al, you correct me on this, but I'll make you bet, most districts in the country today have at least a 65-35 margin in favor of one party.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
Yeah. So when you have a situation like that, you got to worry about being true to your party's position.
So
and if you had a state, if more states would have an independent body of senior, well-regarded citizens, take, for example, former members of the state Supreme Court, former governors of either party or both parties, but people who are out of the political system now and could take a broader view than the state legislature cutting deals with the congressmen.
So an independent commission, like what they have in Washington State.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you were drawing districts, what we used to call compact and contiguous districts with a variety of community interest involved, rather than drawing funny lines all over the place.
Gerrymandering to pick up.
You know, one kind of voter, one party's vote.
Well, Al, who comprises the commission in Washington State? Do you recall offhand?
I don't recall offhand, but it's quite transparently independent.
Traditionally, who have been members of this commission?
You know.
Or how are the members seated? Let me ask that question.
I don't know, because it occurred after I was elected. I mean, it was since I have been out of office, and I'm not really up on exactly how it's done, but so I don't know.
Okay. Ralph, do you know offhand in Hawaii who's on that commission?
Okay. For the Republicans, you have the current executive director, you have the attorney for the Hawaii Republican Party, you have the former attorney for the Hawaii Republican Party, who was chief of staff to Charles Nishu. You have a couple of former state legislators. And on the Democratic side, it's almost the same.
How are they seated?
Well, they're selected by the Republicans select their people, the Democrats select their people. Then they're supposed to kind of come together and agree on the independents. Well, they couldn't. So the state Supreme Court finally just appointed a retired judge to be the last
so,
person.
So to put this into fourth grade perspective of how – so basically – Bob, Al, Ralph, what I'm hearing is that if we were to come up with, as you put it, compact and contiguous districts, as opposed to the gerrymanders we see today, taking it and making it non-political, we will see a more solid middle ground representation in Washington versus the divisive political stance that we see under the current system that lies in, I think it's 46 states. I think four states out of the 50 have these independent commissions.
Well, I think we would have a better situation. To give you a perfect example of how bad it is, after the 2000 census, California had 53 seats. Every incumbent who ran every single one was reelected. Every one. Iowa, which has an independent commission,
correct,
had 6 congressional seats. When those seats were redistricted for populations by an independent group, they had a changeover of 3 seats. 3 seats changed hands. Now, whether they go one way or another isn't nearly as important as the fact that when you don't have any change at all, it shows you that what you have done is just guarantee for life or for the next 10 years the congressional seat to be one party or the others.
Al, you've been a supporter of the commission concept, the independent redistricting community. How does this differ? How are the results different in the independent redistricting commissions, making it non-political, versus we're hearing a lot of talk now, there's new revised talk about term limits. What's the different outcome between term limits and what you're talking about, redistricting independently?
Well, term limits is a totally different animal and an utterly useless one. In fact, it's worse than useless. It's mischievous. And we can get into that if you want. But this is a totally different thing. Look, it is not going to make every district in the nation... it's not going to make every district in the nation become a toss-up district. How are you going to find that many Democrats in Texas to try and make all of Texas?
Or Republicans in New York City.
Or Massachusetts. Yeah. So you're still going to have some Republican districts and Democratic districts, no matter how fairly you do it in terms of the contiguous and so forth. So this isn't going to be a radical decision.
No.
What it will do is it will put a stop to people going in and drawing weird districts that are not, well, they're contiguous but not compact. And that will bring enough new districts into play that are toss-up places that you will drive politics in D.C. more toward the center, more toward the moderate.
It's exactly what we need, and you're right. We're not going to change 3/4 of the seats in the House. There are 435 members of the House. If, in fact, you know, and right now, I would suspect, Al, that there are probably less than 75 seats that can reasonably be said to be in play in almost any election. Now, if that number was not 75, but 150, which still left, you know, 300 plus seats, you know, 300 seats that were partisan. But if you had a group of about 125 to 150 seats that were in play regularly, each party would have a number of members who had to really worry about their next election.
How would it affect?
And that is what you need. You need people in the middle.
Ralph,
how would that affect the minority and majority districts and the voting rights?
Well, the Voting Rights Act is for the southern states, basically is already trying to do something like this.
Okay.
But when you write the districts with the legislatures, you play games.
But when we talk about this, you know, we see, you know, some of the smaller states. When we look at Hawaii, where we have an at-large member of Congress in the House. And two senators.
No.
I'm sorry, Montana.
Yeah. Delaware,
Montana, where you have one member at large, you have two senators, yet we still see the politicalization of there's still that deep-rooted seat in politics. It's going to the far right to get reelected because you now have to go statewide. Does compact and contiguous really take that out of play?
Taking the two, you said that's certainly going to make it more likely to get a Republican out of Montana and a Democrat out of Hawaii because of the nature of those states.
Yeah.
And so be it.
That's
neither Bob nor I are trying to prevent Republicans from electing Republicans and Democrats from electing Democrats. What we're trying to do is to get the people to elect the members rather than the members choosing their constituency, so the constituency has virtually no option but to elect them.
Would it lead to a rise of other parties?
I don't think so.
Green or socialist?
There will always be fringe, but I think the United States is pretty much
a two-party
universe.
Yeah, a libertarian is run in my old district almost every year, every election.
I mean, this country
they don't pick up.
No, and there are green there are green parties in places, but again, they can find room. The point is, if redistricting helps us to have each party more broadly based, it's going to make it unnecessary to have third parties, because the parties within themselves can reflect these different views and still be within the basic outline of the party.
Now,
and to the degree that these independent commissions will also take into consideration the issues that are dealt. I mean, to have a district that is half rural and half industrial makes it a very difficult district to represent.
I mean, you're looking at, I mean, particularly in the Midwest, you know, you go into some place like Des Moines, Iowa, where, you know, where they have an independent commission, making it come contiguous, you're going to have, and you have the possibility of having an urban area in the western part of Des Moines tied into unadulterated farm country, and you're going to get two very opposite ends of the spectrum in that electoral base. Is that healthy? Why?
Well, it's healthy because since both of those groups are going to have to work together to help the district.
And it means the member of Congress is going to have to work harder. For example, in Washington State, we have, largely thanks to the Republicans, one district that is impenetrable for Republicans. That's so that Republican votes can be pulled off into other areas and make them swing districts or Republican districts.
Ralph,
how would this play out in the Latham and Boswell race in Iowa, your scenario that you've laid out?
Well, I don't know what that district's configuration is. But the question is, you know, I don't think either Al or I so much care, you know, in a specific area, is somebody advantaged or disadvantaged. The important thing is that, and Al said it in a very pithy way, and it's the right answer, the voters ought to be picking their congresspeople. The congresspeople should not be deciding, with the state legislature helping them, who they're going to let vote for them.
Let's go back to one element we haven't talked about, and that is the inherent sovereign state right to, in fact, redistrict under the current set of laws. You're gonna be hard pressed, in my opinion. I don't necessarily disagree with the idea of an independent commission. What I do think, though, is that you're gonna be hard pressed to see, in particular, the larger, more populous states, New York, Texas, Florida, California, Arizona. You're gonna see those states start to rise up and saying, wait a minute, as Secretary of State in my respective state, it is my responsibility to, one, certify the vote and be in charge of elections. It is the legislator's right to determine what the districts that represent our citizens in Florida or California and Texas, it is our responsibility to district out what we believe is in the best interest of our population.
And that argument is used, but the fact is that the state, we're not saying to pass a federal law.
No.
We are saying that the states, each state, you're totally right, it's a state responsibility, but there's nothing that says the state can't set up an independent commission. Now, an interesting thing was, in two elections ago, both California and Ohio, as I recall, had initiatives on the ballot.
Exactly.
That would have done this. And the Republicans, Arnold Schwarzenegger in the lead, was promoting the one in California. The Democrats were promoting the one
in Ohio.
And it was interesting. The opposition.
The Democrats killed it in California. The Republicans killed it in Ohio.
And they used the same argument.
Right. I mean, but now we get into a situation where, you know, in each of those states, Ohio and California, you're dealing with strong state legislatures. In Iowa, you don't have a strong legislature in Des Moines. In Washington, you don't have a strong legislature in Olympia. So what we're saying is, it almost depends on, Florida's got a tremendously strong state legislature in Tallahassee. New York, the same. Can that work in those states where the legislatures do, in fact, have that kind of stroke?
By can that work, do you mean can it be implemented?
Can it be implemented? I guess that's the question.
Because it'll work.
You're saying, will the state legislature give up the power?
Yeah, I don't know of a single state legislature that would do that.
In Iowa, it was like they gave Tom Latham the choice whether he wanted to run against another Republican, Steve King, or run against Leonard Boswell, because they had to collapse the one district.
I understand. And we're going to see that all run. Your friend John Dingell is going to have that problem in Michigan.
You're absolutely correct if you're suggesting that to implement Bob's and I idea is going to be difficult, and that the odds are against it in many states. That's absolutely true for the reasons you've given. But I don't think that's the reason to stop advocating it. And if say you got four more states that did it, that would be an improvement.
I mean, you're now talking about the possibility of going to a state like Alabama, Louisiana, some of the more Midwestern states, Nebraska, Arkansas. Those states could be a possibility, but there's going to be an inherent fight. And again, not disagreeing with the concept, it's just that how do we take this theory and implement it in today's political reality?
Doesn't Nebraska have unicameral?
Right. But still, it is the legislature, even though it's unicameral. New Hampshire's the same way. You have a unicameral House and legislature. That House of Delegates, in fact, is going to be the redistricting tool. Some may say that that's independent unto himself.
If what you're saying is this would be very difficult to implement in many places, you are absolutely right. And I wish some of the good government people out there, instead of worrying about PACs and all that crap, had taken this on as a major issue. They could be powerful in that regard, and they haven't done it. I mean, they've been horsing around with PACs and fundraising and all that kind of stuff, and haven't found a solution yet. And I doubt if a solution is possible area.
Alan,
I'm trying to get to my point, which keeps eluding me. Gotta
keep it moving.
Dropping my lap again. Yeah, what's going to happen when there's a picture of me with my shorts with burns all over the crotch?
That's a picture we don't want to go home with.
But you see what I'm saying? It's no reason not to advocate it, because it would be very, very good government policy.
Absolutely. But I go back to the original question. Can, in fact, redistricting change, redistricting reform, going to independent commissions, going to compact contiguous congressional districts, can that in fact help us get out of our current fiscal crisis?
No, because it can't happen soon enough.
Interesting point.
It's impossible to have it happen soon enough. But the reality is we are stuck with what we've got right now that we have to use to solve our problems. We're going to have people on both parties who are adamantly opposed to the deal that hopefully will be eventually proposed to them, and they're going to just have to decide that their job is to be a representative, not just of their district but of the country as a whole. They have to come together and say this is the best of all the solutions we can find. This is the only one we can get a majority vote on.
Ralph, I know.
And I would argue that you wouldn't have a Tea Party if we'd done this before. I have always believed the Tea Party was made up largely of people who saw Washington in a gridlock. And it was in a gridlock because it was already too hard left.
And they didn't feel they had a voice.
And they didn't feel they had a voice.
Well, we're going to before we take a break here real quick, I want to ask two questions, and these are two relevant questions, because this is a subject that I know not only we're going to talk about here on Akron Politics, but it's something I know that the First Congress Society continues to look at as a platform. The question I have for Al and for Ralph, Al, in your opinion, has the Independent Redistricting Commission been successful in depoliticizing redistricting?
It has in the states where it's been implemented.
I'm talking about in Washington State.
Yes.
Your state, has it been effective?
Yes.
Ralph, do you feel it's been effective in Hawaii?
Yes, I think it has.
Okay.
And let me make
it gives the Republicans a voice that they probably wouldn't have because it's such a Democratic state.
And one more observation I would make is that as the nation moves to the right and as the nation moves to the left over time, this will move with it. This is not freezing every district into one part or the other. That's exactly what we're trying to avoid. And so a district that's set up, that is set up is going to have greater turnover over time and have largely
Well, we're going to take a break now. This is going to be a subject we're going to talk about long into the future on Backroom Politics. I think it's a valid issue. I think it's something that we continue to discuss. And again, it's a situation not unlike the fiscal crisis, where if we actually had somebody take a leadership role here in Washington and put something forward, it might take traction. It might take traction. But it's something that we can still continue to advocate. This is Backroom Politics live from the back room on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Chili's Back Room in Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. As always, every Tuesday, Congressman Al Swift the Honorable Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie, and I continue to debate the political issues of the day. We're going to go a little bit into free form right now. The one question we brought up last week in our free-for-all discussion from
when the motorcycles came in.
Yes. Well, in our free-for-all discussion with New York Mike and our friend Robert Patrick, when we talked about Sarah Palin and how unfair the media has been to Sarah Palin. Every time we sit there and we feel like, you know, maybe the media is a little bit unfair, Sarah Palin opens her mouth. And the latest.
Did you ever hear me agree to that?
the latest is her take on the ride of Paul Revere. It is amazing to me, as a student of history, as she proclaims, that she could not exactly nail that down, particularly the fact that everybody remembers, you know, come all ye shall hear the fantastic ride of Paul Revere. I mean, hell, I remember that from third grade in Massachusetts. Now, granted, it was Massachusetts, and we were pretty close to it, but everybody knows the poem. So when we talk about this, it goes to a larger question. It goes back to the credibility of those who have a focal point in today's politics. We saw it with Donald Trump. Now, Donald Trump questionably has political credibility like the window we're looking out onto Epstein. There have been, but at the same time, many people have questioned the credibility of President Obama because of the fact that he basically served 1 minute in federal office, and all of a sudden now he's the most powerful man in the free world. So I posed a question to the round table. Are we putting too much emphasis on their knowledge of history and their knowledge of civics versus their leadership qualities, or is there a certain... is there a certain credibility that is inherently necessary to be a political figure in today's political environment? Al?
I think you can look at Harry Truman, who never graduated college, his business went to pot, and a lot of people, and I do remember this, even though I was very young, discredited him as wholly unfit for the office. He didn't have sufficient training and what have you. What we find out now is he was a student of history.
He was brilliant.
That he read a great deal. That he, in fact, did not come to the presidency unprepared. He came about as prepared as you can expect to get. He had his problems, to be sure, but he made about as many monumental decisions while he was in office as I can think of as any president.
And they were damn good decisions for the most part.
Well, I mean, he today still made one of the most difficult decisions of any president in the history of our country, and that was to use the atomic bomb on Japan.
Yes, he did.
And he did not take that. Those who are students of history, like we are around this table, know that he took that very seriously. But, you know, we look at Harry Truman. Harry, I bring this up because when you bring up Harry Truman, who I am a huge fan of, when Harry Truman left office, Harry Truman had an approval rating about a quarter. 25-27%. Mm-hmm. Not very popular. But history now, as we look back at it and we see the inner workings of the Truman White House, turns out he was brilliant.
Well, it turns out
that he was probably one of the better presidents we've had.
Well, as we see the results of the decisions he made, we realize that at the moment, those people who thought he was wrong or crazy or silly or whatever, they were wrong and he was correct.
Right. But now,
it's most decisions that presidents make that are big decisions, it's very, very difficult to, at the time they make them, see the true repercussions of what they're doing.
There's a lot of armchair quarterbacking, arguably, that happens here. Ralph, your thoughts?
Well, I think Sarah Palin continues to hurt her credibility by saying things that are just factually not true, and that's going to come back to haunt her. I think that's why she's not going to end up running.
But here's the thing about it is that media driven? It sounds like to me that if we had a media the way we do right now, I've always said, if we had a media back in, if we had a 24-hour news cycle the way we do today, America never elects a person in a wheelchair. They never elect a philandering Catholic. If we have the media, is the media in fact driving, you know, some have said that Sarah Palin could in fact be a great leader. She already leads millions of people every day.
Well, I think there were times that she's been unfairly attacked by the media, but she has consistently come out time and again saying things that are just factually incorrect historically. And at the end of the day, people are going to take that to heart.
Well,
and I personally, I bear no malice towards her. I wish her well, but it bothers me when she comes out and makes this factually incorrect.
But we also look at our 43rd president, George Bush. When we look at, you know, a lot of people found him to be unarticulate, almost to the point of stupid, making up words. Does his vocabulary and his public speaking role, those inside the White House in the 43rd presidential administration felt that he was actually a brilliant, brilliant leader. Are we going to see the same thing possibly with George Bush that we saw possibly with Harry Truman?
I think this is, first of all, I am not a fan of George II, but I do think that what was said just earlier, history will decide whether I was right or those who say he was an excellent president were right. And I can fulminate about all the things I think thought he did was wrong, but I may not be around when we truly find out.
Well, we hope that you are. Yeah. Well, we hope that you are.
Drooling in my wheelchair in the old folks home.
Well, you'll have Medicaid and Medicare to help pay for that.
Well,
maybe. In some ways, he was one of the more liberal presidents that we have. If you look at nationalization of the banks, financial institutions, the Medicare prescription drug bill.
One of the things I find kind of amazing is the Republicans seem to have forgotten, as they criticize the current president, is that the current president picked up where George Bush left off in terms of dealing with the
financial crisis at hand.
And it's too soon to give a final conclusion, but that seemed to work. Chrysler's paying back money. And
well, the reality is that the two presidents you just mentioned, Bush number two and the current president, had a continuing problem that they, you know, that didn't stop when Bush left office. It kept on going, and they both had to deal with it.
Now, and Obama had to deal with what the president, had already done. And to Obama's credit, he didn't decide, well, that was a Republican idea, I will, you know.
Yeah, well, they both paid attention to financial advisors who they trusted.
Right.
And he modified it a bit, as George Bush might have.
Sure, if he would have reversed them.
Yeah.
Ralph.
Well, Reagan came in, and he inherited a terrible economy from Jimmy Carter, but I don't remember hearing him complain that, you know, everything was Jimmy Carter's fault. He came in and sort of took the bull by the horns and led the
correct.
Well, I haven't heard Obama say everything
was George Bush's fault either.
Everyone, well, but it's the whole mantra, especially from people abroad, is, well, you know, this is George Bush's fault. You can't blame Obama. And
well,
at some point, Obama has to take credit now that he's in over 3 years.
Well, let's take that off the table for a second. I want to go back to the idea of, you know, when we look at the way the media has portrayed Sarah Palin in the past couple of days after her Paul Revere flub, the way that the media portrayed Donald Trump as being an amateur, somebody who's not really well-versed in politics or history or in governance, are we putting too much stock in what the media tells us about these candidates?
Always. We always do. Good or bad, we always give them too much credit.
Bob.
Yeah, I think Al is exactly right. It takes a while, you know, if you just read the newspapers or watch the cable channels, you get some very skewed views.
Well, and here's something that gets overlooked all the time. We think of people will make defense of this and said, look at all the television stations, all the local newspapers, all these things we've got. There's plenty of diversity out there, da-da-da-da-da. But the fact is, on political things, the D.C. press is the wholesaler. What you read in the Podunk Times is what they got off of AP, which came out of Washington, D.C. The couple of 300 journalists in D.C. have enormous impact on what the local people read in their local paper, here on the radio and here on television.
And what we have never had before are the cable news channels, which are very much skewered, particularly in their evening, you know, programming, where most people watch the news. They don't, because most of them work during the day. And you get very far left, get very far right. You don't have any, what I would call, it's pretty hard to find a cable channel that in their discussions in the evening, their discussion programs, have a, what I would call a centrist or a broad view.
The best place to go for that is PBS.
PBS.
And the three major networks used to do programs that. I'm not criticizing their news coverage, but they used to do specials. They'd bring in their reporters from all over the world, and they'd do
But they don't have those kind of reporters anymore.
They don't do that anymore.
Yeah, our problem is people don't read. They're not encouraged to read books and to do research. Everyone just relies on what they see on the television.
And we've got a caller from the 203 area code. 203 area code, you're on the air.
Hello?
Very unfair in a lot of ways.
Well, let's take a look at let's take a look at for a second when we talk about the media. We talk about how they portray different players, and there's players on. You know, you look at Tim Pawlenty. The media doesn't necessarily give Tim Pawlenty a lot of TV time because he's about as exciting to watch as a mailbox. And yet, Tim Pawlenty was a very successful governor in Wisconsin.
Yes, and he was a Republican.
Or Minnesota. I'm sorry, Minnesota.
Minnesota. He was a Republican governor, relatively conservative, in a relatively moderate to liberal Democratic state.
Right.
And he did very well, and he was elected several times, and he got things through the legislature. He's the kind of the middle guy that we're trying to find nationally.
Right. But yet, we don't give... Same thing with John Huntsman. John Huntsman isn't exactly an exciting candidate to reach out to. Doesn't get a lot of media time, but could he in fact be the leader that our country's looking for?
He's getting a lot of big name people behind him. I was with
You're supposed to be quiet so I can say that as my I want to tell you something.
Well, you know what, Bob? I will tell you right now. We will go, because we got 10 minutes left in the show. That's going to segue us into Tell Me a Story. You have a Tell Me a Story. Bob?
Last week, I said on this program that I thought that Huntsman was going to be pretty significant. I think in the last week, I've seen several things that indicate to me that he is beginning to register with people. Not just the media people, but some of the voters where he is. I think he's doing some pretty good things. I don't know whether he'll win the nomination or not, but he is certainly the kind of a fellow who has a broad enough experience as a business person, as an ambassador, as a politician, a governor, twice elected. I think he's going to be a serious candidate. He's coming on relatively late, you know, in the game, but I think he's going to be. I think the fact that so many other Republicans started late means that he's really not late.
Mitt Romney announced this week, and Mitt Romney has got a war chest that's about the size of the gross national product of Brazil.
Yes, that's true, and he also had the same thing 4 years ago.
True.
He's being attacked.
Is that Huntsman is going to be a significant factor.
I think
if he doesn't win it, you'll have to beat him to get it.
Wow. Interesting point. Ralph, tell me a story.
The international community is going to ramp up against Assad in Syria. We're going to see a resolution coming out of the UN Security Council, similar to what has been going on in Libya.
An interesting turn of events. It looks like President Obama is now backing the Secretary General of the UN openly in a lot of decisions that the UN is making. Is that going to give a lot more credibility, do you think, to the UN? Is that going to make it easier for us to pay our membership dues into that organization?
I think so, and I think the U.S. is going to have a lot more credibility and respect among the UN, much to the dismay of hardcore conservative activists.
Interesting. Al, I'm going to go to you, just because it's a roundtable. Do you have a story for Tell Me a Story?
Otherwise, you'd leave me out.
You never have a story to tell me a story.
I never have a story. I believe that by the time you get to the Republican convention, the clown show will be over. That it will, the weird people in that are going to have disappeared somewhere along the way, and it will probably be a contest between probably Romney, Pawlenty, and guy we just mentioned.
John Huntsman.
Yep. Unless somebody else comes in.
Now, I think you're exactly right.
There's one, no pun intended, dark horse in this.
Chris Christie?
No, Chris Christie, we know is out. I'd bet a year's salary that Chris Christie is not going to get into this race.
There's people trying to draft him.
Yeah, there's going to be people that are going to try and draft him. The one dark horse in this is going to be the entrepreneur from the great state of Michigan, the gentleman who owns Godfather's Pizza,
Herman Cain. Yeah,
Herman Cain is getting a lot of publicity.
People like him.
People like him. He's dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
He is, you know, he brings in a lot of excitement in what he's saying.
He could be one of the minor candidates, quote unquote, that is still alive going into the convention.
My suspicion is that he can't raise enough money and develop enough support among professionals who can help him, and he's going to need help because he doesn't, you know, he's a businessman, not a politician. I think that his biggest problem is being able to build a good campaign team and raise enough money, and I think he can't do it in the time, there are too many other people.
You're probably right, but he at least has credibility.
Yes, he does.
As the other three that I mentioned have,
no.
As the clowns.
Let's be civil.
I won't name them. As the clowns, whether somebody finally pulls off their red nose and we see.
So this poses the question now, Bob and Ralph, is does Newt Gingrich stay in the race?
No.
Al?
Gotta be smart.
Ralph?
I don't think Gingrich is going to get a lot of traction.
Does Sarah Palin run?
No.
Al?
No.
Ralph?
No.
Okay. Last question before we call it a day. Out of the entire Republican ticket right now, who gets the nomination in 2012? Al?
Well, that's the kind. That's bar conversation, and I define bar conversation as a bunch of guys sitting around talking about something they know nothing about.
By the way, welcome to our show.
That's how it started.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're in a bar in Washington, D.C. Welcome to bar politics. Al?
And what was the question?
Who's the Republican in 2012?
I honestly don't know. I think it's up in the air at this point. Last week, I think I said that it would be Romney. But let's see how these other guys come on. They really haven't had a chance to get known, and they really haven't had a chance to present their things.
I want to ask this question every week just to see how dynamically the answers change. So you're saying you're sitting on the fence on this one this week. You said Romney last week. You don't believe it's Romney anymore.
I don't think as time goes on he will be the putative front runner. He'll be a factor.
Right.
But Valenti is likely to be a factor. What's the other guy?
John Huntsman.
John Huntsman. I think he has the capability of being a factor. And your friend from Godfathers.
Herman Cain.
Yeah. I'm glad somebody here has got a memory for names. when you called him a dark horse without any irony in it, I it's too soon to count him out. He's got a long way to go, but he has got the qualities of
sense. He's an exciting guy.
Right. Bob.
If you think I am going to be so foolish as to tell you who I think will be the nominee, you're out of your gourd. No, I don't know who's going to be, and it's so fluid right now. I think anybody who would bet a dollar, on it, would be almost sure to lose the dollar.
Ralph?
Form holds, according to past Republicans.
I'd bet you a dollar.
Excuse me.
Pay it. You still have a bottle of wine.
Right. Oh, I'm still waiting. Thank you, Al. I will share it with you.
Ralph, if form holds, according to the way the Republicans select their nominees, it would be Mitt Romney.
Okay,
but the dark horse is Huntsman.
I will tell you right now, the correct answer here is Mitt Romney, and we would have also accepted Herman Cain. But Mitt Romney's going to be the Republican ticket in 2012.
Just so people know, when are you going to buy Bob the bottle of wine, and what was that all about? They don't know.
We'll talk about that when I present him the bottle of wine.
And don't forget, does anybody have a choice for vice president?
Oh, we'll talk about that next week. That'll be our roundtable quiz next week. This is Backroom Politics on behalf of Congressman Al Swift, the Honorable Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie. I'm your moderator, J.T. Russell. This has been Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street.
Which is the place to be.
In Washington, D.C. Tune in next week at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio for our continuing discussions on everything inside the Beltway. We will see you next Tuesday. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you.